Welcome to the Legal Academy, a podcast about law professors. I'm your host, Oren Kerr, a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley. This is an interview-based show in which I'll interview leading law professors about the Legal Academy. We'll cover topics like legal scholarship, teaching law, university service, and everything else that law professors think about. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Legal Academy, episode 11. I'm your host, Oren Kerr. My guest this week is Randy Barnett, the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Legal Theory at Georgetown University Law Center, and also the director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution. Randy graduated from Harvard Law School, was a state prosecutor in Chicago, and then a fellow at the University of Chicago before starting as an assistant professor at Chicago Kent College of Law in 1982. In 1993, Randy moved on to Boston University, and then in 2006 to Georgetown. He's written widely in contract law and constitutional law. His most recent books include A Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People, and also An Introduction to Constitutional Law, 100 Supreme Court Cases Everyone Should Know with Josh Blackman. Randy, of course, is a leading member of the Legal Academy, has been prominent for many years. And Randy, I'm just really excited to have you on the show.
Well, I feel honored to be in the roster of guests you've already spoken to. So I hope I can hold up my end.
Absolutely. No doubt. So I wanted to start actually with a great part of your experience is you've been a law professor now since for almost 40 years at a range of different schools. And I wanted to talk about the changes that you've seen over time. So how has the Legal Academy changed in that almost 40-year career you've had?
Well, it's changed quite a lot, actually. Let me just think of the first thing that comes to mind is that if you wanted to keep up with law reviews, you basically went to the faculty library and you saw the 10 or 15 or 20 top law reviews that the librarian had selected to be on display at the faculty library. So there are no faculty libraries anymore. Who needs them? And law reviews are no longer distributed in hard copy to any great extent. It seems like a minor thing, but it's symptomatic of a big change in the Legal Academy. And that is, it just doesn't matter as much where you teach as it used to. So let me just go through all the different ways in which it doesn't really matter as much where you teach than it used to. Because starting at Chicago Kent, I've had, as you say, a number of experiences, Chicago Kent, Boston University, Georgetown, and I've also visited at Harvard twice, Penn, Northwestern. So I've had quite a few different faculty experiences. And then when I get to why it doesn't make a difference, then I'll get to where it does make a difference. So the law review, how do you read a law review article? That makes a difference because it used to make a huge difference where you published your law review article. So the top journals got read. Anything below the top journals didn't really get read. So if you didn't publish your article in a top journal, and my first big contracts article was published in Columbia, which was a huge breakthrough. It almost made the cut at Yale. I was told, I found that out once a Yale Law Journal member became a member of my faculty and told me that they decided to go with a different piece, and then which they decided they didn't like as much as my piece at the end of the day. It made a huge difference. I mean, being Columbia was good enough, I should tell you that. It was a breakthrough article. It makes a huge difference where you were because otherwise you simply didn't get read. It was like writing a law review article for your own benefit. It was like a moot law review sort of thing, a moot law review article. Nowadays, since we all get feeds and we monitor SSRN and we monitor however else we monitor electronically, what pops up on our screen is a law review article. Now, where it got placed, who's publishing it pops up also. But doesn't really matter that much. It could matter a little bit. I'm not saying we're not influenced by these things, but basically the article's already in front of you. You're there because it's the topic. You're there maybe because it's the author. And so you're not there because the law librarian has picked those journals and put them on display in a room that you have to go to see what's going on. So that's huge. So that means it doesn't matter as much where you publish. And that means it doesn't matter as much where you go to where you're teaching in order to place your work. Because even though I think law professors are much less hierarchical in their thinking about other law professors than they used to be, and that's another big change we should talk about. law students remain very hierarchical, ironically. They fought hard. They feel very, very, it's very important to them that they got into Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Chicago, Columbia. This is like hugely, and so therefore when they're on the law review board and they're evaluating articles, they put more stress on the status of the law professor who's submitting than we law professors now place on who we read. And so I think it is an advantage of teaching at some places that your articles are better placed. But my point is it doesn't matter as much if your articles are quite as well placed as it used to, when otherwise you wouldn't get read at all. So that diminishes the importance of where you teach considerably. The other thing that is very important is, and I should have led with this, I wasn't thinking of it in order, so this is in no particular order. The other thing that matters is that when you went to a law school, because of technology, your colleagues on the faculty were basically your colleagues, the only colleagues you had. And if you didn't have good colleagues, you weren't going to get much help from your colleagues on what you're working on. I remember when I circulated that contract law article I told you about that was accepted in Columbia to somebody else on my faculty who taught contract law, what I received back from her was basically a spell check and grammar check. Now, before we had spell checkers and grammar checkers, that was not worthless. So my spelling could be improved and maybe my grammar too. But it wasn't substantive. So where you were teaching made a big difference because your cohorts were going to influence whether you're going to have a good intellectual experience and career or make yourself better intellectually or not. Your faculty workshop would matter. Well, now, of course, our colleagues are those people who are in our field wherever they may be. I mean, just look at this podcast, for example. You know, I don't remember. What school are you teaching at now, Oren? I can't keep it straight.
I'm at Berkeley now.
Oh, Berkeley. Yeah, well, that's a good school. I knew that. I knew that. But it doesn't matter. You're sitting where you're sitting. I'm sitting where I'm sitting. And we're talking to each other. We know each other already. And our colleagues are the people that we know, usually in our subject matter, but not necessarily in our subject matter. And so I don't rely on my Georgetown colleagues for any feedback on my work. And I haven't since I got there. I mean, I'm in my 14th year at Georgetown. Now, my Georgetown colleagues are smart people, but they just happen to be people who have offices near me. They're not anybody special as compared with you or other people. I'll give you another example. I have a book that I'm writing with Evan Burnick on the 14th Amendment. Original meaning of the 14th Amendment is letter and spirit. So it was accepted, happily, it was accepted for publication, but before it's, you know, goes out for publication, it was accepted by Harvard Press. But before we turn this in, we want feedback. Well, where am I gonna get my feedback from? My first choice was not to go to my colleagues at Georgetown for feedback. I mean, with all due respect. What I did is I organized faculty workshops with a number of faculties who had people on the faculty who I thought were both knowledgeable enough and respectful enough of the kind of work I do to give me constructive feedback in advance of publication. So, I mean, who I pick will tell you something about the hierarchy of law schools and why, you know, what matters. So we had Zoom faculty workshops at George Mason, Scalia Law School, University of Virginia, Notre Dame, Hillsdale College, not a law school, we have one coming up yet with University of San Diego, where there's an originalism center. Right. So I figured in terms of the value, you know, that the chances of getting positive, constructive feedback, not the next question, not hostile questioning, which is what I would get from my colleagues. It would be okay. It just isn't going to help me write the book, which is what I need now. I need feedback now, constructive feedback that I can integrate into the book. How can I make this better? That's what I did. And now I pick those places because I know people at all those places whose opinion I respect. And I wanted to hear what they had to say. And I'll tell you, there's a sort of a hidden agenda. I wanted them to read the book in advance of it coming out. I wanted them to know it was coming. I wanted to know the argument was in the works. And I want, and, you know, so it was, it, now that's how things are, that's how business is done today. And because of, thanks to Zoom, of course, we've now amped all of this up in the last 6 months beyond any recognition, right? Thanks to a COVID. I don't even know where those people physically were. They were organized by the people at those faculties, but they were everywhere. Who knows where they were? And it, we had these faculty workshops that turned out to be very, very valuable.
Yeah,
So
and
that's,
what the dynamic you're identifying certainly matches my sense of things. I've been doing this for 20 years now, and I've seen even some of that shift. It was mixed when I started in 2001, and now it is so much more so the way you describe that people, you can kind of have your colleagues be anywhere, and the people you're communicating with can be anywhere. And I think that has all sorts of really interesting implications for what law schools are, because as you say, if a law school, if you're at a certain school and you're not interacting with your colleagues necessarily, in part because people may not be in their office. Now, obviously people are, it's illegal to be in their office. So
right.
that's
This
an
is
unusual
actually,
situation.
this is so good for me because I don't go to my office. So now I'm like equal with, I'm there's a leveling playing field. I'm not, I'm like everybody else now. This is fantastic.
So there's now it's, it's extreme. But even before COVID, there is a dynamic. There's a really interesting sense in which, if law professors are not in their offices, if they're just going in to teach and then they're going home and their colleagues are people all around the world who they have chosen, regardless of what their institution is, like, what does that mean for law schools as intellectual homes or as sort of coherent, cohesive groups? Is it just inevitable that the student experience will be their professor teaching their class, but the intellectual life of a school is sort of, I don't know if I want to say non-existent, but like it's that's not the core of what's going on
I agree
anymore,
with
is
that.
it?
I think that's what's going on. I mean, I think that changes what's happening. And it didn't used to be that way. I mean, it really, as I said, it was a limiting function. You went there, you got the culture of the faculty. That was your culture, which is a reason to move on if your culture is not a good one. And I actually spent a year, not another law school. I spent a year at the University of Chicago Law School before I was teaching as a fellow. Their culture was very distinctive. And it was very aggressive and intense, but very, very, very academic and scholarly and rigorous and all the rest. But it had a very special culture. All the other law schools I've been associated with have had different cultures, but I think you're right. I think the culture of the place doesn't matter so much. Look, I don't even know for sure what the culture at Georgetown really is because I don't participate. I know this is terrible. I mean, I shouldn't be admitting this publicly, but I don't participate, and I haven't for some time, in those sorts of activities with my colleagues at Georgetown. I like them personally. I think they're nice people. So there's nothing personal about this. But I don't, time is, life is short, time is scarce. And after you've been doing this for 40 years, nearly 40 years, you're going to find time is even more scarce than you can possibly imagine. And so there, that, on a cost benefit basis, it's not worth it. And so I have work to do, I have a life to live, and I need to be get constructive feedback and interact with people who are more in my world. And I don't mean by this cocooning either, because look, you and I don't agree about a lot, but we're colleagues. And it came about as a result of being on the same blog. Otherwise, we wouldn't be colleagues. We probably wouldn't have intersected at all, you and me, because we don't do the same subject and we don't have the same approach and to anything in life in general, I think. But we're on the same pod. We're on the same blog, and then we mixed it up a lot during the Obamacare case and got to know each other better as sort of intellectual adversaries in a very constructive way. And as I said in the book that we did together, the compilation about the Affordable Care Act, you vetted our case more than any other single law professor before we went to the Supreme Court. You were a big reason why our case was as strong as it was because you kept vetting it on a daily basis. We became colleagues that way. And so that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about cocooning with people that you agree with. I'm just talking about hanging out with people
Sure,
who
if
are
it's me
helpful.
or yeah. So sorry if there are audio problems on my end. I don't know if my connection may be unstable or not. I'll just proceed and hope it works out. But so I was hoping maybe you could talk about the teaching side of things. Is it different at different schools teaching wise, and that could be teaching loads, it could be the background of the students, it could be lots of different things.
All right, so now I'm going to say why it does make a where it does make, well, I already suggested one place it makes a difference where you teach, and that is law review editors are quite hierarchical, and it's going to be harder to place your articles in a higher ranked law journal if you're from a lower ranked law school. So that is a negative. Again, doesn't matter as much now, but it's true. Where it really matters, and which motivated me to move really from school to school, is the students. The students are what's, and I've said this for many, many years, long before there's been this leveling effect. I've said law faculties are more alike each other than different. And this has always been true. It's just that at least since the 80s, when law teaching became more intellectual and less trade school, law faculty, and then people started hiring people out of the top law schools who were more intellectually inclined, and they were teaching all over the country. Good people are all over the country. That's why we don't judge people by where they teach as much as the law review editors do, because we know good people everywhere. Because the law schools have been seeded, the intellectually inclined law professors have been seeded out throughout the country. But that's not true of the students. So the faculties tend to be similar to each other, but if you go into class and your students are not intellectually inclined, I'm not saying they're not smart, I'm just saying they're just not intellectually inclined. They just got what they're interested in. They're interested in something else. What's something else? Well, they want to practice law. That's what they're interested in. And what they also have a pretty narrow understanding of what they think you need to know in order to practice law, even though I never understood how they could be so sure of that, since they have not practiced law, but I had practiced law. But they were very confident that they were right and I was wrong about that at Chicago Kent. Unless you have an unbelievable thick skin and are really, really stubborn, eventually there's a limit to how much you can push them without just sort of giving up and sort of teaching to essentially what the students will allow you to teach, because if you, they push back. They, I mean, they I shouldn't say they push back. They resist if it's something hard. And that's no fun. And basically teaching was no fun. And I thought it was me. I thought this was just me until I visited Northwestern while I was still on the faculty at Chicago Kent. And my students were amazing, and my students love me and I love them. And it was like, oh my God, I mean, it's not me, it's them. And so I had this fantastic contracts class. In fact, Marcus Cole, who has just become the dean of Notre Dame Law School, was in my contracts class at Northwestern. And I'm the one that suggested to him that he might want to be a law professor one day, which he was very adamant that he didn't want to do. And now he's the dean of a law school. So I moved on to find students that I thought would be better, who would be more fun for me to teach. I'm not saying better for everybody else, but for me, it made a big difference, because I couldn't take a more intellectual or theoretical approach in class without getting an intense amount of pushback.
Give me a little bit of a sense of I think I know what you mean by that, but I think people that are watching may not know exactly what kind of difference. Is it talking about criticisms of what the courts, let's say it's a public law area like constitutional law, is it like critiques of what the courts are doing, or sort of theory things where some students are going to say this is great and some are going to say like, what, why are you wasting my time with this? It's not actually the law. I mean,
yes, to the latter is what they always say, but the former depends on what subject you're teaching. And I was teaching contracts. And so basically in contracts, it doesn't matter what court is deciding the case, because the famous cases come from all over the place. But I was teaching the theory of contract law. The underlying theory of contract law. And that amounted, and there was different theories, like there's the reliance theories, there's the bargain theory, there's the consent theories, there's the efficiency theory. These are just different theories of contract law. And I was teaching them alongside the doctrine and because I think you sort of need to understand what the deep structure of the subject is to really understand the doctrine. This is not the podcast in which I want to go into the details of all of this, but I don't think that the law student's vision that you come to law school, you memorize a bunch of rules and you go out and practice law is how it works. I think you internalize the structure of subjects and you essentially keep teaching yourself the law as you practice law going on. So I'm trying to teach the structure, which in the case of contract law was teaching the theory.
Okay.
When I teach constitutional law, I do teach it differently. I don't teach it from a theory out. I teach it from a narrative standpoint, because I think what makes constitutional law different is that the doctrine is really subsidiary. Whereas I think in contract law, the doctrine is pretty central, and that you need to understand the theory of why the doctrine is the way it is. In constitutional law, history has determined the law we have. And so I think understanding the narrative of what happened from the founding until today is the way you understand how doctrine has developed from the founding to today. So to understand the substantial effects doctrine and where it fits in everything, you actually need to know a lot about what led up to the New Deal and what happened in the New Deal and what happened since the New Deal. And then you understand Darby, you understand Wickard, and then you understand Raich. And guess what? You're actually able to formulate a challenge to the individual insurance mandate on the basis of all that understanding that other people haven't seen, because there's a structure there that you get as a result of seeing it chronologically. So that's just a different approach. Now, I never taught this at another law. I taught it at Boston University a little bit, but I've basically been teaching this way at Georgetown. So I don't know how this would work at the other schools. I think it might have worked pretty well because it's a story and people love stories. But theory didn't work so well. So I guess here's the thing I will say that at some law schools, and I don't want to dump on Chicago Kent. I think this is, they gave me my job, my first job. I was there for 11 years, and they were good to me. And I like my students personally. They were, and I respected them. But they made it hard for me to teach. They made it hard for me to enjoy teaching. But when I went to Boston University, then it was better. The students didn't mind being pushed this way. And but what I was missing there were students that would push me back, would actually engage what I was saying and say and disagree and say, no, wait a second, that doesn't sound right. You know, like you do, Oren, you're a very good student. But I wasn't getting that at BU. I was getting, they were not resisting me anymore, but they were actually not stimulating me. They were not pushing back. And
Right.
I did get that at Northwestern. I did get it when I visited Harvard, and I get that at Georgetown. And so
Okay.
my teach, and I think the same thing is true with the student experience. That is, I think if you're a more intellectually ambitious student and you are going to a school where your peers are not intellectually ambitious, you're going to have a more frustrating law school experience than you do if you go to a law school where your peers are pushing you the way they're pushing me in the classroom. And I think that's the variable that separates law schools from each other. That's the reason why you want to go to the sort of the best law school you can get into. But if you're that kind of student, I suppose if you're a student that doesn't want any of that, don't go to a school like that. But most students do. And so there's a sorting thing that takes place there that's much more important for law students than it is for the faculty, except insofar as it affects how the faculty can teach them at the different law schools.
Okay, interesting. So I wanted to turn to a different topic, and that is you could call it politics or ideology or however you want to phrase it. You're a noted libertarian or classical liberal scholar, and I want to get your sense of how you think that has impacted your experience in the academy. And there are different ways of approaching that. One would be kind of how that changes maybe how you approach the job potentially. And then it also, there's the question of are law schools open to people from different ideologies, or how do law schools grapple with people with views that are different from the majority? And that could be, in some cases, libertarian, it could be someone really far on the left, it could be all sorts of different ways in which ideology you can be a sort of dissenter from the group. And so,
Right.
how should we think about those questions? How has that impacted your career, do you think?
Well, in many ways. I mean, I know for a fact that I was discriminated against on the basis of ideology or politics from my entry-level jobs to every other level of my career. And I know for this for a fact because I was told by, let's say, the chair of an appointments committee who had unanimously recommended me to a faculty, and then the faculty voted me down. Why the faculty voted me down? That was when I was an entry-level person. Now that's not all the schools that wouldn't even interview me, or I couldn't get past the first interview. These are schools where I actually got to the point where the committee had recommended me, and I didn't get the job. And that has happened on lateral jobs as well. I know. I mean, I had an offer for a lateral offer where the faculty unanimous, the whole faculty unanimously voted me the offer, and then the dean did not extend the offer to me. And I found out only actually within the last year that the reason was is some left-wing members of the faculty went to him, even though they voted for me, it was with unanimous faculty vote, they went to him and backdoored him and said, you can't hire this guy because it's going to make our faculty too conservative or too this or too that. And then he didn't hire me. He refused to extend the offer. Nobody's ever heard of that, but it happened to me. So now, having said that, let me just say, every law school that's hired me has not discriminated against me. They've all accepted me in. So that means every faculty I've ever actually been on has not posed any kind of problem for me politically. I mean, it's not to say I haven't had any unpleasant experiences, but I would say that actually, you know, since I've been at Georgetown, and this would be applied to my, it would apply to the previous schools as well, but since I've been at Georgetown 14 years, I can count the number of unpleasant experiences I've had with a single colleague that I would attribute to politics on the fingers of one hand, and I'd have fingers left over.
And then what do you think?
You can't complain about that.
No, I'm curious though, what do you think is the reason behind the sort of reaction you're describing of is it, are law schools just not open to dissenters from sort of agreed upon norms? Is it something specifically about views associated with conservative libertarian ideas? Like, to the extent you can say, kind of what is it that's driving that you think explains the reaction that you've personally
had? Right, first of all, I should say that I think libertarians experience less discrimination than social conservatives do. I think it's much easier despite the discrimination, it's much easier to get a job and even be accepted as a libertarian than it is as somebody who is a social conservative. I'll repeat myself. But here's what I think. I think it's just it's pure majoritarianism and groupthink. I think if libertarians were in charge and they had the overwhelming numbers, if social conservatives were in charge, excuse me, and they had overwhelming numbers, they'd probably behave just the same way. maybe I should say that, because there is a bit of authoritarianism creeping in to ideology on the left that is starting. I mean, ideology on the far left has always been authoritarian the way it is on the far right. Well, the far right doesn't control law schools. Neither did the far left. Until recently, law schools were controlled by what, when I was a law student, I referred to as corporate liberals. They were just sort of standard mainstream Democrats. That's who ran Harvard Law School back in the day. Well, of course, they were challenged famously by the critical legal studies group at Harvard. I was gearing up while I was a student. It didn't come out of the closet until after I left, but I'd seen it. I'd taken courses from Roberto Unger and Morton Horowitz. They were my teachers. And so there was this attack from the left, and their enemies were not conservatives. Their enemies were liberals, liberals in today's sense of liberal. And it still is today. When the liberals were in charge, there was a lot of condescension by them towards anybody who wasn't like them, especially people on the right. But there wasn't overt, terrible hostility and enmity like we're starting to experience more today, as I think the left comes to dominate. I don't think they quite dominate yet, but as they're coming to dominate legal academia, I think the situation is going to get worse this way as opposed to better. As long as people like Alan Dershowitz were the kinds of folks that were liberal, there was a belief in freedom of speech and free discourse that you could take advantage of. But now, of course, we know that that's under threat.
And what do you make of the counterargument that's often heard in response to sort of the perspective you've offered? I've heard the following along the lines of, there's not discrimination against people based on conservative or libertarian views. It's just that there aren't very good ideas there, and sort of the market is speaking by sort of people not thinking those views are good views. Sort of how in other words,
exactly.
I think there's really sort of a challenge to the, how do you know what is sort of the objective merit question when there's disagreement on those fundamentals? How do you keep those?
That's just another way of restating the same thing. Of course they think that. They think that nobody who holds these political views, there's two templates they have about people who disagree with them politically, people who they view as on the right. One is they're either stupid or they're evil. And neither one of you qualifies you for a position on a law school faculty. Neither stupid nor evil. And so you have dumb ideas. I mean, and they know they're dumb because here's what's wrong with them. Therefore, the scholarship is no good. They used to say that about law and economics too. I mean, they didn't agree with it, so it's bad. So it's really hard for faculty members. And I think this is true of everybody. I think it would be hard for, it's hard for me to do it in reverse. It's hard for people who disagree with something strongly enough to think that there's merit, enough merit to justify an appointment of somebody like that. Now, that's stated in a very neutral way, but I actually think there are ways of figuring out merit. I mean, I'll give you another example from my own personal history that I just mentioned this on Twitter this week, so it's not going to be news to you if you were following my Twitter feed, and that is that I wrote a paper between my first and second year of law school on restitution to victims of crime. I used it to satisfy my third year writing requirement at Harvard. And I asked one of my professors, Lloyd Weinrib, to be my research advisor. Here's the first thing that he was a tip off that this might have been a problem, and that is he made me sign an affidavit because I was getting some funding for my summer. He made me sign an affidavit that the people I was getting funding from was not going to make me reach some particular conclusion. Okay. That should be a tip off that something was up. It was the Institute for Humane Studies, which is this radical group, of course. And so anyway, so then I submit the paper and I get a B+. I thought, okay, fine. It's a B+ paper. I had also submitted to a philosophy journal. And then actually it took a long time for this, the peer review to happen. It was a peer review. It's ethics, one of the top two or three philosophy journals in the world. And maybe a year later, after I was turned this in, I got this grade, my paper got accepted. It's gone on to be reprinted like 17 times in teaching texts and anthologies. It's kind of a classic in the field. But it didn't get an A from this guy. Now,
did you ever go back to Professor Weinrib and tell him that the paper was accepted in ethics?
Oh, sure. Of course I did. He said it was very happy for me, you know. And actually my way of getting back at him was after I became a law professor. Of course, he wouldn't be a reference for me in the job market either. He said he would be, I asked him to be a reference for me. I shouldn't have said this by name, but what the hell? He said, well, I can be a personal reference for you, but I can't be a professional reference. And he said, I don't even know what that means. I honestly don't know what that means, but whatever it means, this was after the paper was published in Ethics. And I had a follow-up paper published in the American Journal of Jurisprudence. And he still couldn't be a reference. He couldn't be a reference for me in the job market. And the last thing I will say is when I did visit at Harvard Law School, he took me out to lunch at the faculty dining room. And the first question out of his mouth was, so who does a libertarian vote for this year? It was a presidential election year. So this just shows you, he thinks Randy Barnett, libertarian. He never got past that. From the day I was in his criminal law class, to that day I was a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. I was just one thing to this guy. I was a libertarian. And I may be an okay, he might like me personally, but professionally he couldn't recommend me.
Okay, interesting. So I wanted to turn to the center.
Let me just say, Oren, that I feel uncomfortable telling that story publicly because I actually haven't told that story in so public a way before. But since people deny the reality of this experience, people, as you say, people on the left or deny that we on the right experienced this thing, it's useful to hear what actually happened. It happened, and you know, this is what really happened. And so it's not like I'm just imagining this happened. It did happen. This is what happened to me. So I think it's useful to tell the story.
Okay, interesting. So I did want to turn to the Center for the Constitution.
Sure.
So you have been a professor for many years, and then the Center for the Constitution, I assume you founded and you're the director. And this raises, I think, a really interesting question about the role of law school centers. So various schools have centers or programs specializing in certain areas. And I wanted to get your sense of what you think the role is of these different centers. And thinking, starting more broadly than your center, although that's obviously a relevant data point. So, you know, if you're a law student thinking of going to a law school, should you focus on the centers that it has? Do centers matter? Are they kind of more about the research agendas of particular professors? How should we think about these? Because you can imagine a law school that has, you know, a center for every faculty member or some specialization. And then you kind of raise the problem of how do you know what's real, sort of a real program versus something that's just, you know, a website and some, how on the outside can you tell, and what is the role of centers in your view?
Well, unfortunately, it's hard to it's hard to give a blanket answer because centers are so different from each other. It's hard to generalize because, you have our Center for the Constitution. We are an academic center. We are about ideas. It's an extension of academia, legal academia. Our focus is on the Constitution, how it should be interpreted, with an emphasis on originalism. But what we don't take positions on anything. We don't have policy. We don't do policy. We don't do litigation. Other centers do policy work. Most of the centers at Georgetown are not academic centers in our sense of our center is. They're policy, they're in-house think tanks. They're like taking the Cato Institute or Heritage and bringing them into Georgetown on either be on public health or national security or other. And they have conferences just like a think tank has. They're in-house think tanks. Other centers or institutes are more like in-house public interest law firms. Supreme Court clinics are kind of like that as well. And so they're so varied that it's hard to say. My own case, which I don't think is representative of most centers, frankly, is that my center is an extension of my academic scholarly interest. It's a way I associate my center with Robert Downey Jr. What's his character with the Iron Man, right?
Okay.
Iron Man, right? I got the right character, right? So it's like there's Robert Downey Jr., who's a pretty powerful mogul and all that stuff. His character, right? And then he puts on his Iron Man suit, and then he can do all kinds. He has powers and abilities way beyond that. So there's me, Randy Barnett, law professor at Georgetown. Then there's me, director of the center, which gives me powers and abilities primarily to help a lot of people elsewhere that I wouldn't have as a law professor. And so, for example, we have the summer seminar, originalism summer seminar, where we bring in top law students from around the country to teach them about originalism. We have an internal Bradley Fellows program for our own law students who go to our programs. We have a student fellows program for any Georgetown law student who wants to attend our programs. We give out a book prize every year, $50,000, to professors to honor them for their works. I have visiting scholars come in from other law schools to write a book or do some major research on my dime, where we'll pay for one semester of off from where their home schools are. These are generally law professors who come from schools that are lower ranked than Georgetown is. So it's kind of an honor for them, and it boosts them at their own home institution to have come to Georgetown. But they get a semester off, which their school might not be able to afford to give them. And so the primary mission, the primary activity I'm engaged in my center is helping other people. But of course, I'm doing so with my own intellectual agenda in mind. So we most recently awarded our Thomas Cooley, and we also want to honor, one of the other part of our agenda is to honor famous neglected figures in our historical past, our constitutional past. So we have our Salmon Chase Lecture at the Supreme Court, co-sponsored with the Supreme Court Historical Society. And we have our Thomas Cooley Book Prize and Judicial Lecture. So our latest Thomas Cooley Book Prize we just gave to Sean Wilentz, who's a historian at Princeton, a left of center historian at Princeton, for his book, No Property in Man, Slavery and Anti-Slavery at the Founding, which tells an incredibly important story about how people at the Philadelphia Convention resisted the push to include an explicit endorsement of slavery in the Constitution, and how much difference that made after the Constitution was adopted. So, but that book prize, which honors somebody, the recipients typically tell us this is the biggest thing that's ever happened to me. And I mean, Sean Wilentz has already won a Pulitzer, I think. So I can't get over how excited he was to get this prize, but he was. It's advancing them. But of course, I care about anti-slavery constitutionalism. It has been an interest of mine for about 15 years. I just, for some reason, it caught my fancy maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and I've just been absolutely fascinated by anti-slavery constitutionalism, and this book just fits my intellectual agenda. So by helping someone else, I'm helping myself. with my Iron Man suit on. But I don't think that my center is typical. I'm not saying there's no other centers like that, but this is a, but other centers, I think, much more have a particular focus like a think tank would have. And so they have different people. It's not so much the, it's not so much the projection of one person's vision, which my center is more about. It's more about me, in a sense, and my agenda. So for me, and this is why it's important to mention this to other law professors, for me, a center is a way of advancing my academic agenda, as opposed to distracting me from my academic agenda, which other outside activities or administration, because there's a lot of administration goes with having a center. You do administration, you're getting away from your academic. Well, my, I don't like the administration end of it or the fundraising end of it necessarily, but the point is that it's all meant to advance my intellectual agenda, like publishing a book. When I publish a book, I got to work with a university press, so I got to work with a press. So that's just one of the, that's how you get your agenda. So that's what my center does. So I really think, not that there should, everybody should have a center, not that, I think everybody should strive to have a center. You should strive to, it's like Oprah, you should get a center, you should get a center, you should get a center. Provided you view it the way I'm viewing it, as a way of advancing your academic agenda.
So this goes great, very nicely into the next question I had, which was, you have a much more public face orientation of some of your work, and that you're appearing on shows that are public, like you were in, like I saw recently you were on Mark Levin's show on Fox News with your talking about your book, and so actually sort of going through your recent book with Josh Blackman, and that book itself, I gather, is sort of intended not for an academic audience. It's intended.
No, it's not. I didn't have a copy here. I would hold up my book. I should hold up my book. I'm not prepared. Wait, I'll be right back. No, I'll just. So.
How does that fit in? Because that is unusual in a couple of ways. One, in that it's you're obviously trying to reach a public audience. It's very conscious, and it fits, I think, with the center idea, right? You've got a set of views that you're trying to.
No, not quite. I mean.
Okay, good.
Well, yeah. Tell me. Up until now, that hasn't been true of the center. Up until now, the center has been entirely academic. So I was about to correct you, but then I realized we have another program we're getting running. It's called Originalism Beyond Academia. And so yeah, we are trying, but we are trying to do this as an educational mission. So to educate beyond the law schools is what we're trying. Well, that's what I mean by beyond academia. So you're right. But anyway, let's go back to your, I shouldn't have tried, you're actually right. And I shouldn't have contradicted you. So yes, what was your question?
So I'm interested in how you think about engaging with the public. So you're a law professor. You've written many, many books, many articles, taught for many years, and you're doing this very high level sort of academic theory and works of history, and then you're spending a good amount of your time trying to engage with the public, trying to teach non-lawyers, people that are watching cable TV, here's how to think about the Constitution. And I want to know kind of why is that important to you? What are you trying to achieve when you're doing that?
Well, I think ideas have consequences and you want your ideas out there. I also kind of have this sort of intellectual view that if you can't explain your idea in a simple enough manner for people who are not specialists to understand, that there might be something wrong with your idea. It's not that you can explain it in its fulsomeness. All the theoretical stuff is necessary, but you ought to be able to boil it down to a point where it could be explained to people. It's sort of a sign that you're actually capturing something that's true about the world. I think maybe it's a bit of a conceit, perhaps. One of the things that's kind of interesting is if you take the Obamacare challenge case. As you know, I was principally responsible for developing the argument as to why the individual insurance mandate was unconstitutional beyond the powers of Congress. That was based on both my understanding of the structure of constitutional doctrine, but that itself was informed by my former litigation experience in the Raich case, the medical marijuana case that I argued in the Supreme Court. It was litigating that case that exposed me to the deep structure, in my opinion, trying to figure out what was going on there exposed me to the deep structure of the Commerce Clause and Necessary and Proper Clause. That, okay, that's all complicated. It took a law review article to try to explain all that when the Obamacare case came along. So I did that. But then, of course, as the litigation gets started, all the lawyers from around the country came and consulted with me. There were lawsuits all over the country and in most circuits. And they all would call me up. We'd have conference calls. Sometimes they would come to DC to see me. I wasn't one of the lawyers. Then I became one of the lawyers after the District Court of Florida ruled. I became one of the lawyers for the National Federation of Independent Business with Jones Day, who were the law firm handling the case. So what's interesting is once we got into that phase of the lawsuit, what was my job? Having developed the theory, I wasn't writing the briefs anymore. I wasn't writing the briefs. They were writing the briefs, and they did a fantastic job with the briefs. My job was to go and deal with the press. I was the public face of the lawsuit, and I spent a lot of time at TV studios, all kinds of TV, Bloomberg, CNN, MSNBC. I did them all. As a division of labor, lawyers who charge however many $100 an hour they charge for their work, they can't afford to sit in a studio and wait to be for 5 minutes debate, but law professors can. So I had to reduce our theory to sound bites that could be digested by the general public. And I think actually successfully did that. And part of that is a skill that I think I picked up somewhat. Part of it's just the way I think, but part of it is because I was a criminal prosecutor before I was a law professor. And if you're a trial lawyer of any kind, I happen to be a prosecutor, but if you're a trial lawyer of any kind, your success or failure depends on your ability, in the case of a prosecutor, to convince 12 citizens that you're right about this important issue to the point of confidence that they are unanimous and that they are unanimously in favor of sending somebody to the penitentiary, which is something people are very reluctant to do. And you have to do that when they are not allowed to ask you any questions. So if you can't explain your theory in such a way as they can understand it, you're going to lose your case. So you can't talk. And if you talk down to them or condescend to them, you're going to lose your case. So you have to figure out a way to communicate. And I attribute some of my skill set in this regard to having been a trial lawyer before I was a law professor. But who knows where it comes from for real? I don't know. That's just part of my background.
And then do you see the litigation work and the books for the public as sort of integrated and a part of your academic law review article work, or is it more like it's just a separate thing that you do that you enjoy? Or,
no, it's all the part of the same thing. I am an academic. Look, you don't have to be an academic. You can be a law professor and not be an academic intellectual. You could do a lot of other things as a law professor, and that's fine. Everybody doesn't have to do the same thing, but I am first and foremost and have always been an academic. And so all of this has to fit my academic agenda, in some way, shape or form. For I turn down way more opportunities than I accept because they don't fit my agenda. Now, every once in a while, you come up with an opportunity that you didn't expect that's going to take you away from what you thought you were going to do. And you have to say, well, wait a second, should I do this? And then it turns out I volunteered to give some advice to somebody writing a brief in a medical marijuana case in like 1998, I think it was, because they wanted, their trial judge said they should brief the Ninth Amendment. They didn't know anything about it. So they're in California. So they came I was one of the leading experts on the Ninth Amendment. And they called me up at my office in Boston University and said, you know, we're writing this brief and the trial judge wanted us to talk about the Ninth Amendment. Would you help us? So what's the case about? They told me it was about medical marijuana. So I said, yeah, well, it's a federal law. So the Ninth Amendment happens to be relevant to it. So sure, I'll help you. So I helped them write a few pages of the brief. Well, if you have another hour, I can just tell you, which you don't, and neither do I could tell you how that phone call and my willingness to say something about the Ninth Amendment over the phone and led to the Obamacare case. First of all, arguing the medical marijuana case in the Supreme Court and then doing the Obamacare case. It's all just because I took that phone call. I was, you know, I wasn't even an expert on the Commerce Clause at that point. I was an expert on the Ninth Amendment. I became an expert on the Commerce Clause as a result of my work in that case. So But that's litigation. That's a little different. Some of these other activities really do fit a broader intellectual agenda. I think my comparative advantage, and I think that's what everybody needs to think about. What is your comparative advantage? Or in an Aristotelian sense, what is your highest end or purpose? To be happy, you need to fulfill your potential. Well, everybody's potential is different. We're unique individuals. So I think my highest end or purpose, if you put it this way, is to both develop intellectual concepts and ideas. And generally speaking, I think my real skill set is in combining things that people haven't seen go together. It's a more, I put together structures of ideas, and that creates a theory. And that's just something I think as the way I look at things. So my highest end is to develop intellectual ideas. And then I think I'm also, you know, decent at conveying them to other people. And the biggest challenge for that, and I was thinking about mentioning this a few minutes ago when you talked about the public, is I had a trade book published. Our Republican Constitution was published by HarperCollins. I'd never published a trade book before. I didn't know if I could write one. I thought it would always be the highest thing to have your book that would be in the airport. And not only was my book sold in the airport, it was actually sold at Costco, which was like amazing. I never saw it myself, but some people took pictures of the stacks of my book in Costco. So it was a trade book, and I turned this, I got an agent, because I'd never had an agent before, because to get a trade book, you need a literary agent. So I got an agent. Getting the agent is a challenge. I got an agent. He took the book, he marketed it, he sold it to HarperCollins. I turned the book in and I thought, hey, I'm done. This is great. And I went out to dinner with my editor at HarperCollins, thinking we're celebrating in New York. We're going to celebrate this deal, right? Celebrate is done. And he said, well, you know, there is a problem. It's not accessible enough. It's not accessible. I mean, I thought we were done. The book's over. What do you mean it's not accessible enough? And so he gave me a piece of advice. He said, I was hoping it wasn't the prose, because I couldn't write any I didn't know how to write any more clearly than I wrote. And I can't just change my writing style. So what do you mean? He says, it needs more stories. Okay, needs more stories. I think I can do that. I went back and I rewrote it. And what I did is I decided for each chapter to find a story that would start the chapter. And it could be a historical story. It could be a personal story about me. It could be just a story that illustrates something. Like Thomas Jefferson had to write the Declaration of Independence. What was that like? And when I did this, when I added the stories to each chapter, I actually at this point realized the chapters were not exactly in the right order anymore. And it was hard for the reader because they kept chronologically bouncing this way and that way. So I reordered them so it was one narrative story, a big overarching story punctuated by a story for each chapter. And it actually affected my understanding of the substance to do it this way. I got a better grasp of what my own theory was from this exercise. And then when I turned it in, I held my breath because I thought, you know, I haven't changed the prose. I've only added stories and I reordered the chapters. God, I hope he thinks it's successful. And he goes, oh no, you totally nailed it now. You got it. So that should tell you something about the ability to communicate what is a theoretical idea, the nature of sovereignty, and the nature of judging within what is sovereignty and what's the role of judges in a constitutional republic. Given the nature of sovereignty. That's pretty academic and that's pretty theoretical, but it's all told by means of a narrative such that it's accessible to the general public.
Great. Randy, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been really, really interesting and helpful, and I appreciate it.
Well, invite me back anytime, and congratulations on doing this podcast. I have been tempted to do a podcast. I was thinking about doing a Lib Law Prof podcast. But I was afraid it would be too much time away from my academic agenda. But maybe it wouldn't be. But anyway, I admire you for the fact that you've been doing it, and I'm really honored, Oren, that you invited me to do it.
Oh, you were one of the first people I thought of. So I'm so glad. I'm so glad we could have it work out.
I hope I didn't say anything indiscreet. We'll find out. We'll find out if anybody listens, watches the podcast.
As the host, I think that's perfect. All right. Thanks so much, Randy.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Legal Academy. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us at wherever you rate podcasts. If you'd like to watch a video version of this episode, you can find it on YouTube at channel The Legal Academy. Finally, you can also follow us on Twitter at The Legal Academy. Thank you.